You've probably heard a lot about Bitcoin lately, whether it's on the news, online, or because your weird mate Steve keeps banging on about how much his is worth. There's a lot of noise and information, and it can be hard to know where to begin. Coin Corner cuts through all the confusion with an easy-to-use site and a friendly customer support team on hand to help. Coin Corner is a quick and easy way to buy Bitcoin in the UK. Visit coincorner.com and enter code FilmBTC at sign up for some free sats or small amounts of Bitcoin to get you started. Coin Corner.
The Podfix Network.
Hello and welcome to episode 229. Of the Filmmakers Podcast. This is a podcast where we talk filmmaking, from indie film to studio films and everything in between. How to get them made, how to make them, and how to try not to fuck it up. In a very, very humble opinion. Today on the show, I am chatting with screenwriter and producer Jennifer Cooney and producer and director Tracy Wren, who made the fantastic indie film Rainbow's End. I sit down with the girls and we talk all about how they scripted the film, how they learnt from editing, what co-directing was like, why you should always storyboard, and what it was like working together as a scriptwriter and a director. Jennifer talks about how she learned to be a better scriptwriter by being on set. Tracy Wren, the director, talks about working with actors and why directing is blocking. And they go into detail about their distribution profile and how they got Rainbow's End onto Les Flix for their online release. They also give you some amazing advice about filmmaking. All that is to come on this week's episode of the Filmmakers Podcast. I am Giles Alderson and I am currently directing my fifth feature film. At the moment it is called, if you don't know already, if you're not a regular listener to this podcast, it is called Wolves of War, and it is a World War II feature film starring Ed Westwick, Rupert Graves, Matt Willis, Max Hildebrandt, Eva Magyar, Anastasia Martings, Sam Gittings, and Jackson Booz, along with many, many other amazing, talented people. And I have to say, I've been blessed with my crew. I mentioned it last week, but I have been. Not only my cast, quite frankly incredible, but my crew. I've really loved filming this one. I mean, really loved. I got so much out of the others, of Arthur and Merlin and The Dare and Stranger in Our Bed and World of Darkness. But this one, I don't know, I've really enjoyed getting up in the morning. That sounds strange when you have no sleep and you're absolutely knackered, but I've wanted to wake up, I've wanted to get to set. I haven't forced myself into the shower or forced myself out of bed, which is what happened on Arthur and Merlin, but that doesn't surprise me because on that film it was raining every day, as I've pointed out many, many times. It got to you. It was really difficult every morning knowing it was chucking down with rain and you had to go out and get soaked and try and make a movie in the rain when it's really difficult. People don't want to stand there in the rain while you set up the camera and wonder where your next shot's going to be when it's raining and suddenly the mud's moved it and the location's changed and it's all new and you've got to find it on your feet. It's really hard. It is. Whereas on this one, I've really enjoyed playing. I've enjoyed coming to set, even when it has been raining. You know, it's that thing, isn't it? You can't appreciate the sun unless you've had rain. And I definitely say that was the case on this one because some of the days have been really sunny. And I ain't complaining. Believe me, when you're on set and it's really sunny, it's really difficult because you've got to block out the sun. But it makes for a better set. And people don't mind spending time lying on the grass while you set something up or having a chat, having a cup of tea or a biscuit or whatever they're doing when they're waiting for you or your team to do something. And that's really important. Same for the crew, the wonderful makeup team doing touch-ups or the costume. We don't mind waiting when it's sunny. You don't mind. I think it's hugely important that you don't run before you can walk. You know, I feel sorry for those directors who get massive movies when they first start for the first feature. It's been a joy for me to work my way through the muddy waves of the indie filmmaking world and the difficulties and the struggles and how you've got to cheat things and make things work and the compromise you constantly have to do as an indie filmmaker. And if you're jumping straight into a big studio feature, well, you're not really compromising. You're kind of getting what you asked for. And therefore, the pressure is huge on your shoulders. There's no excuses now. None. It's your fault. people are just going to blame you. And even though they blame you on an indie film anyway, the director gets the shit, the actors get the shit in the reviews. But at the same time, you're doing the best you can with what you have in front of you. And that's all you can ask for. And that's why it's incredible. And that's why I'm so glad I've learnt from the ground up. And even though the day was a studio movie, it was a very, very low budget indie studio movie for what a studio movie normally is. And from there, yeah, I picked my way through it. And now I'm at the point where I'm loving being on set more than ever before. Before, I loved being a director. I loved working with actors, but there's so many problems with it. Now, you know, when you've got a great team around you and there's an amazing production team putting out fires before they get to you, well, you're in a brilliant position now to just be creative, to be the director, to work with the actors and the camera team to create what you want to create. But if no one's putting out those fires for you, you've got to deal with those fires. And that's where it gets very difficult. So my advice to you, if this is possible when you're going out there to make your indie film, is have the best team around you. And you can do that by asking. Find the best production manager, find the best producer, find the best that you can get, and hound them as to why they should do your project. Don't settle for anything less. Don't settle for someone who isn't good enough. It's too hard. It's really important for you to do that on your first film, second film. Just honestly push as hard as you can to get the best. That's where you need to spend the money. Then that's where you spend any money you might have when you're making your indie films. Because at the end of the day, people will blame you. It's your fault. And it is. You have to hold your hands up. You have to take responsibility because it is your project and you employed these people. I jotted some notes down while I was on set. Just things that I wanted to talk to you guys about that might help you, you know, when you're going to make your films, or just things you can relate to. And one thing I've noticed is when you write the script, or when you rewrite the script as the director and you put your director's vision on it, the locations that you write down aren't actually where you shoot. They're just an idea in your head. It's a fantasy. You make it up. Your mind goes to these wonderful places of other war films. So for me, you know, I'm imagining Saving Private Ryan. You know, if it's a sci-fi film, you're imagining Aliens or Terminator. Well, actually, good luck with that. Your locations won't be that. So whatever you write in that script suddenly becomes gospel. It becomes real. It's there. It's fact on the page in front of you. And everyone tries to recreate that. But you don't get that. You get a field. Rather than, you know, you want the Terminator end of world madness, but you don't. You get a field. And that is really important to know when you're writing the scripts. To be realistic within what you think you can get. And as soon as you find the locations you're actually shooting at, change the script instantly. Go back to the script and rewrite it to fit those locations. Because if you don't, when you get to set and you're suddenly doing it that day, you go, oh my God, we're doing that this morning. Oh, right, damn, where were the actors going to be? Oh, it's a totally different room. Because you will get there and things will change. Every day, something will change. We did that constantly on Wolves of War. Okay, this location, let's just move it here because this is better. This is more beautiful. Stu, the DP, will come in and go, why don't we shoot in this room? Look at it, it's better. Great, okay, but that means the door's different and they need to come around that side. Cool, fine, you can adapt on the day. But I tell you what, if you've got a big field and that's what you've got, write it into the script you've got now. And the other thing I want to say, I'll save some of these till next week, but the other thing is vital. This you take with you whenever you're on set. It's the biggest piece of advice I could ever give you. Have good shoes. I am serious. I don't think I sat down more than 5 minutes a week on this film. And even then, that might have just been lunch. And then you get asked questions and you're doing other things. I'm on my feet all the time. Stu White, the DP, was probably on his feet even more than me. This says everything. You have to have good shoes. And by that, I mean waterproof. By that, I mean comfortable. Because if you can't stand up, your feet are killing you. That's really difficult when you're standing on your feet all day. I don't know if any of you have ever worked in a shoe shop or in a cafe and you're stood in those bloody shoes and your feet are killing you. This is what it's like on set. So I'm telling you and warning you and preparing you. Have good shoes, ladies and gentlemen. Right, I will give you some more tips and tricks I've learned from making Wolves of War next week. I've had a blast. It's amazing. I've got one more day to go, and that is today. If you're listening, I'm recording yesterday, obviously. So Tuesday is my last day. So if you're listening today, this will be on our last day. And we've got a big plane scene to do, a World War II bomber plane. So wish us luck with that. I can't wait. I'm so excited to get into the edit of this film. I hope you are well. I hope you're making films, and I hope you're enjoying this podcast. We've had some amazing guests, and Tobias Vies, our brilliant new editor, has been doing a great job while I've been away, and he's been getting my intros from the middle of nowhere and terrible email reception. He's doing brilliantly and putting them up. So shout out to you, Tobias Vies. Do follow him on Twitter and say you love him and say thank you for doing a great job. His Twitter handle is @VsTobias. A bit like Nora Lakos last week. It's Lakos Nora, and Tobias is Austrian. So I imagine that's the reason he's done Vs Tobias. Tobias can't respond. So anyway, do follow him. And we have some shout outs for our amazing listeners. I did some last week, but we have some more. You are all amazing. But here are some people who gave us extra love on Twitter or our Instagram page, which is @FilmmakersPodcast. On Twitter is @FilmmakersPod. And do write to us there if you want to come on the show. If you like this, then please get in touch. Lynn Marie Swan, Neil Chordia, Paul Doherty, Martin Neely, Chloe Chasmuda, Chris Hughes, and Peregrine Kitchener Fellows. Chloe Chudasama, she's a producer from Nocturnal Pictures. Her film she's making with Leroy Kincaid as the director, which is called The Last Rite. Will be out soon, and both Chloe and Leroy will be on the podcast soon. Oh, and do check out our website, thefilmmakerspodcast.com, where we have a back catalogue of all our podcasts. So if you just want to focus on screenwriting, then just type in screenwriting in the search bar and all the screenwriters will come up, including Oscar and BAFTA winners. Or if you just want directing, do the same and you'll get a whole host. Big old list there. And the same for producing and any other crew members, etc. we have had on filmmakerspodcast.com. And obviously a huge shout out to our Patreon top tier subscribers, Marley J. Munro and Kevin Piebus, and to all the new Patreon listeners, welcome. And if you haven't joined our Patreon yet, please do. Why not come support us? Because we have special bonus episodes. And this week, Toby and the team of Hugh and Callie have put up a new episode with the last 2 weeks' guests, Nora Lakos and Carolina Gropper, and they've put them together. Two amazing female filmmakers. So do go check out our Patreon page, where we have loads of bonuses for you to learn more about filmmaking and what we do. So that's our Patreon, and that's our shout outs. And if you like this podcast, tell your friends, because that is how we grow. We have some amazing guests for you coming up. I will reveal them very soon, but for now, sit back, relax, and enjoy our episode with Tracy Wren, director and producer, and Jennifer Cooney, screenwriter and producer of Rainbow's End. Enjoy. Or should I say End Joy? Rainbow's End Joy? No? Here it is.
Hello.
Hello. Are you two both in the same city? Are you nearby each other? Have you seen each other during lockdown?
Not at all. Well, I'm in Santa Monica, California.
Oh, okay. Nice.
I'm in northeastern Pennsylvania.
Oh, okay.
We're on opposite sides of the country.
Yeah. Totally. So you've not seen each other during this lockdown at all?
No. We haven't seen each other since we finished shooting, really.
Wow.
A lot on Zoom, though.
Yes.
A lot on Zoom. I think that's sometimes the issue, isn't it, as well? We see each other on Zoom a lot, and we can get that Zoom tiredness that sort of ekes into us. Have you found releasing a movie in the sort of COVID times, you know, on Zoom, having meetings like that? How's that process been for you both?
For me, it's been great because, you know, the saying was always you need to be in LA to make it in the business. And I've always lived in Pennsylvania. So for me, this is just kind of one-upped that capability of connecting with people no matter where you are. Especially, you know, going through the editing process, working with the composer. The composer was in Canada, the editor was in Chicago. So instead of, you know, traveling all over the place all the time, it was very easy to just sit down and pop on Zoom. And And it really changed the way that we distributed it as well, with everything being shut down. And so when we found Lesflix, it was just the perfect pairing.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I totally agree. As much as I reckon this film would have done really nicely in cinemas, you could have done a few select cinemas. I could see how it could have worked. But
Definitely. At
the same time, you know, you've got an audience who are sitting at home waiting for movies like this as well, right? So it's almost like, here we are. This is perfect timing in some way. Is that how you felt, Tracy, a little bit as well, that it was perfect timing, or would you have preferred a different setup for this one?
No, I think it was just right. And I do think with the lockdown that I know I've been watching more movies and concerts and doing a lot of reading. So I think other people are too, from what I can tell. And I think it's a great venue for the release of a movie, an online. It's because it's reaching the audience that wants to see this movie. It's really specific. And that's what's so great about it. I don't think we'd have that in a theatrical release.
Yeah.
Totally. Although it would be fun. And maybe we still can do, as you say, mm-hmm. a few select cinemas. And it's been in a couple of festivals too. Mm-hmm. And maybe it can be in more as well.
Yeah, I think so. I think when it ends a little bit, I think there are going to be festivals, and this is obviously a perfect festival film anyway, but I think it can slot nicely. You know, you can now have your release and then you can go, cool, those who liked it, come and watch it on a big screen, right?
Yeah, as long as that we can find festivals who will take a film that has already been released.
I
know there are some. They're out there.
Yeah. No, I've had that in the past. There was one of my movies that came out in America before it came out in the UK, and the UK festival, the big one we wanted to put it in, they went, yeah, we have it. Oh, we've just found out it came out in the US. And we're like, oh, really? That's going to stop us? Really?
Yeah.
And they do. And it's such a shame.
And then Les Flix would have to agree to that too. And I don't know what their policy is, but they might say yes.
Yeah, we can always ask. I think that's it as filmmakers. That's, isn't it, what we do? We just ask. The more we ask, the more we get, right? You know, that's, I totally feel that way. And Rainbow's End is a really gorgeous film. And you were talking there about the niche sort of market of something like this. And it is very niche as well. I'm not sure about that, but I think you can certainly make it for a niche audience. But I think this goes much bigger than that, which is why I love it. But it is important to know who your audience is when you're making a movie, right? And this does fit into that niche box. Was that always the plan with Rainbow's End then, to go, look, this is what we're making, this is the target audience, let's keep pushing through on this? How did it first start? How did it come about in the first place?
Well, in 2015, I got an email from one of my screenwriting friends from France, and he said, hey, I saw a job posting on Stage 32 for a lesbian family drama, and I thought of you. So I just sent my number to this guy. I didn't have anything to show for it. I didn't have a writing sample. I didn't have a list of awards. I just said, I think I'm the person you're looking for. Here's my phone number, never thinking again about it. And I was like, I talking to my wife, I'm like, oh, I applied for a screenwriting job today. Oh, okay. Well, you know, everybody gets their first rejection. You know, that was the conversation. And as we're having the conversation, the phone rings and it's a Chicago unknown number. And I was like, oh my God, this is him. And I answered and we talked for 45 minutes and I immediately knew exactly what he wanted to do with his story and his characters. And it was just, it had already come to me, and it was just the perfect pairing of creative voices at that time. And, you know, that's Joe Orlandino. So he's the one that has credit for the original story. So that was about 6 years ago, I guess, at this point. And Tracy came on Tracy, how long before filming did you come on? Was it about a year and we worked on the script together?
Mm-hmm. A little less than a year. I think it was in the late summer that we really started working hard on the script, and we filmed in March the following year. So yeah, we did a lot of tweaking, and I think we dropped a character and maybe a scene or two and combined scenes, and right up to last minute, we kept doing that, but it just got, you know, better and better. So
that's always the way, isn't it? It's so important to constantly be honing your script, especially when you're finding locations that change things, or an actor change things, or you know, I noticed at the beginning you didn't show a lot of the child, and I thought maybe you'd taken out some scenes with that, but maybe we can get on to that as well. How did you go from sort of going, okay, cool, you know, you, Jen, you'd got the script now, you'd gone away and wrote that. How did you develop it? How did you actually go, okay, well, you know, Joe's come up with the story. Did you then piecemeal it together? What's your process when you're a screenwriter? Do you put notes upon the wall? Do you just stick everything out there, do a vomit draft, and then come back to it? How did you do it?
I honestly wish that I had the capability to do a vomit draft. Like, there's so much for me that goes into it prior to that. I work with a gigantic whiteboard and just write ideas all over it. And I use, you know, index cards and just tons of notes on Notepad. I really like writing down my notes for it like slows down my thought process. But for me, something that I wrote on the whiteboard really early on was, this is a film about war, because you have this child who can't be anything other than he is. And you have this woman, Hannah, who can't be anything other than she is. And they, mm-hmm. they're both right in their own way. And they both see the other as wrong. And how do you rectify that? So that was kind of a guiding light for me throughout writing the whole thing, and also reflected in Hannah and Jules' relationship, because they have very different parenting styles, lifestyles. They really just approach life in a fundamentally different way. So it was all about, how do you rectify contrasts and differences between people? And I think that really comes across when you pay attention to the characters in the film.
No, it totally does. Was there times when, like, say, what do you do when you're struggling? Because there's the screenwriters out there listening, you go, okay, well, you know, I've got a scene, or I don't know how to write this scene. You seems like you go through it brilliantly with a fine tooth comb before you even sort of almost put things down. And I love the idea of a huge whiteboard with everything on it. I think that's great. Visually, it's really exciting. Do you find you have certain times when you write as well? Like you say, is there a process, or is you just sit down and go for it?
No, it's really whenever the spirit moves me. Sometimes it's as mm-hmm. soon as I wake up. Sometimes it's right before I go to sleep. I really just go about my day and make sure that I'm always making time to write. And the thing I love about the whiteboard is that you can sit back and look at it all and just kind of let the different pieces marinate and bounce off of each other differently. And for me, it's definitely always about the character. I don't write plot driven. It's always, well, the next plot point can't happen until we figure out where the character is going and why. So for me, it's constantly mm-hmm. asking why the character is doing what they're doing and why they're going where they're going.
Yeah, which is super and really lovely sort of way that I feel to do it, because sometimes you can just sort of chuck things out and then go, oh, I'm lost, I'm stuck, how do I now get from into the next scene? And you can, you know, suddenly stop and not doing it. At that point, did you know, obviously, did you have producers on board at that point? You know, because I know RB from Stage 32 is one of your producers. Had it come through that system that they're making it, it's already happening? Or is this, you're writing this on spec at this point with the hope that it'll get made?
You know, I never doubted for one second that the script was going to turn into a film. And I think that's one of the most important factors in getting a film made, is never doubting its final manifestation. Yes. And, you know, Joe Orlandino is such a driven producer, and he and I just clicked so early on that it was like, well, of course this is going to be a movie. So there was never wondering about it, and that was really a blessing.
Yeah, absolutely. What about for you then, Tracy, when you came on board, you know, at that point, like say you carried on developing the script, but did you feel that this was ready to be made? You know, what was the process when you first got it? How did it come to you?
Well, I had met Joe a couple of years previously at the American Film Market in Santa Monica. And we, you know, chatted for 10 minutes, and he said, I'd love to, you know, do a project with you. And then it was, you know, we kept in touch, but about a year later he called and said, I think I've got one. And so he sent me the script. By the time that phone call happened, you know, it was going ahead already. I think they must have had some of the budget already in place. They had most of the locations, which there are only a few, but they had the main locations. And then it was a matter of settling on the, you know, when we were going to do it and casting, which Joe really did most of the casting. And he was trying to find the right person for the lead. You know, there were certain things he had to get into place. And definitely by January, it was all in place. And you know, I just kept saying, well, I'll believe it when I see a plane ticket. And then there was a plane ticket. And then I thought, well, I'm going to Chicago. And, mm-hmm. you know, I'll believe it when the first time we say action. And,
yeah, exactly.
You know, it blossomed, and it was great.
Isn't that fascinating for us as sort of directors, creators, filmmakers, that we do, it's almost like, yeah, no, it sounds wonderful. And people talk a good game, and you go, yeah, I'll believe it when I get to that stage. And then you get there and you go, I'll believe it when I get there. And you know, it's just what it's in us, right? Because, you know, we've been burnt so many times. And
yeah, it wasn't that I was expecting that, but I just, you know, it's just my practical nature. That little voice in there says, well, this is good. This is good. This is good. And then if the rest happens, that'll be fantastic. And it did.
So. Absolutely, which is lovely. Let's jump back to Rainbow's End in a little bit. It'd be really interesting to talk about how you both got there. Tracy, when you made your first feature, I mean, did you, sort of what I can see is you co-directed, is that right? You worked with other people. Yeah, mm-hmm. Great. Just talk about that, because that first time is always fascinating for any filmmakers. Mm-hmm. Making your first is always the, right, we've done it now, and you guys have done it, mm-hmm. and it's, you know, obviously Tracy a couple of times now, three times now. So even though you've produced other movies as well, can you remember what that was like, what the process for mm-hmm. you was like? I'd love you to talk through that.
Yeah, sure. Well, the first, you know, real movie I made was a 17-minute short called Neighbors with Gil Bellows, and that was an adaptation of three Raymond Carver short stories. So that was really my first drama, in that, you know, I worked really closely with a phenomenal DP, Dennis Maloney, and, you know, we did everything right. We had all the crew that needed to be there, and, you know, phenomenal cast. And I learned a bunch on that. That was a 5-day shoot. And by the way, I also learned a lot from John Murphy, was the editor of Claude and Albert. I mean, we spent a couple of weeks editing that film together, and, you know, he was just so amazing, so solid. And everything he said, I found came true later on.
What was he said? What can you remember what he said that would be useful? Because for me, editing is so important, and learning and understanding that craft is mm-hmm. just, it makes you a better filmmaker, I feel. I think it's really important. Can you remember what, uh-huh. what he said?
Well, my instinct was to put everything in there. You know, everything that I'd filmed, I thought was so beautiful, and it just had to be there. And I would say, "But oh, but this is important, that is important." And so he really taught me the meaning of, you know, less is more. And he would show me, he'd say, well, look if we, because I also learned about the rhythm of the film. You know, if you put too much in there, it bogs it down. It's slushy. And once a film sort of starts to roll, you want to keep it rolling, and it picks up momentum. So the last thing you want to do is slow it down once it's going. So that took quite a while to learn. But he also said to me, he said, I think you might look back on this and say this is one of the best films you ever made. And I said, no way. And he said, well, there's a lot of good stuff in here that I don't think you're aware of. So he said, you might find it's hard to make another film this good. And that was totally true. That was mm-hmm. absolutely true for many reasons. But what was really neat about Beautiful Destroyer, which was that first feature, is that Christopher Dora was the other director, but he was also the writer and the lead actor in it. And so
got you.
I actually coached an actress and helped her with her audition reel, and she got the part. And so that's how I met Chris, through her. Mm. And I said, Chris, you don't happen to need another director working on this film? I mean, what a crazy question. But he said, actually, I do. He said, I do. He said, because I'm in about half the movie and I need someone to direct those scenes. So what was really fun about that movie was that not only was Chris just awesome to work with, but he really enjoyed sort of taking a producer role more than directing. So I even got to direct a fight scene and I don't think it made it in the final movie, but they even hired, you know, the ropes for one of the fight scenes, where when an actor gets hit, they fly up in the air. Yep, it was absolutely. Just great. And I got Kirk in that movie. He was in the scene. Mm-hmm. Kirk Kelly Conn, who's in Rainbow's End.
Yes.
And
the great name. Yeah, it was. Super name he has.
You know, every film's a learning experience, and you've got to roll with whatever's there.
That's what it's all about, isn't it? It's taking that and then moving forward with it. If you don't learn from the things you've just done, then it doesn't help you. And it seems like you did, because you then, you know, Rainbow's End was technically your next movie.
It was the third. There was one in between, which is called Mumu and the Three Witches, but they changed it to Mumu and the Three Sisters. It's on Amazon. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of a kid action adventure that involves witches and cats and magic spells.
Which is brilliant. So I suppose, Jen, the moment for you when you feel like it's happening, like Tracy said there, it was like, okay, yeah, I'll get on a flight. This might happen, that might happen. For you, what was the process like there? Obviously, you'd been working on this for a while now. Can you remember that time of when, you know, this is actually happening, this is moving forward, and, you know, starting to get cast? Talk us through that, if you can remember.
Yeah, I think when I really started pinching myself was when I was packing enough clothes to be gone for a month. to go to Chicago, where I was like, okay, this is actually happening. I'm going to Chicago. We're actually filming it. Leaving my wife in the airport. It's just like, okay, see you in a month. It was just like, that's when it really started feeling real. And, you know, we actually, the production designer signed on off the bat, and she was doing a lot of the work preliminarily, and she had gotten in a car accident. And last minute, she said, I can't do this. And she pulled out of the production. She's like, I can't energetically handle this. And I was in Chicago already. I got there maybe 10 days or a week early, and Joe called me, and he was like, so here's what just happened. Can you call your wife and see if she can do it? Because Jen's an artist. And I said, well, I can do it. I said, I'll do it. And I said, I'll be right there. And I literally hopped in an Uber and went over to set. And until we found Samantha Merkel, who is our credited production designer, and she took over days after. But until we found her and she got there, it was just like, oh my God, okay, let's do this to the set. Let's create this. Let's paint this wall this color. And it was just watching the set come together and watching the little nook of toys where Hannah and Jules were going to have their opening scene, like building all of those moments. Oh my God. It was like, I was taking pictures of myself with the set, like sending them to, you know, friends and family, just going, this is the first scene. This is where we're going to be filming it. And it was just, it was completely magical. So for me, that's when it really kicked in.
How nice. How lovely. Tracy, when you first saw those sort of locations and stuff, do you suddenly start getting your ideas of where you're going to put the camera? And what's your process there? Have you already done your storyboards? Have you already done your shot list? Mm-hmm. Or do you come to set and go, right, now let me look and see? Unpack that for us.
I always storyboard everything at home with using, you know, a layout of the room and or the location. But I don't necessarily do a shot list, but I kind of star some of the storyboards, you know, like this would be a great shot to get. And one thing I did on set was I bring little people imaginary people, and I sort of recreate the set, and then I use like a kind of one of those big paper clips for the camera so that everybody can see what's going to happen, because that was really helpful a couple of times in the cafe when there were several people doing things at different times, you know, the actors, and just so everyone can get a visual of what it's going to be. But it wasn't really until it was Kevin, the DP, and I really talked about the shot list for the next day on the evening of the current day. Mm-hmm. And then I would go home that night and type it up and send it to Jessica, and she'd send it to everyone. Yes. But I had already done it first in my head, then with Kevin in the location. And, you know, it still got changed sometimes the next day. But
of course. No, I think it's really important. I certainly did that on my first movie. I got little action figures, if you like. I was in Bulgaria where we shot, and I was like, okay, I need to go get some figures. How do I even find a shop that might sell these little figures? And then the same, I just put them in place and go, well, I'm gonna have the camera come around this way, and then suddenly everyone, oh, okay, I know what you mean now. And yes, I love doing that.
Easier.
Tracy, you're absolutely right to do that, to show people go, ah, because sometimes when you're trying to describe it, it's all up in your head. Is, you know, it's like, oh, it makes sense up here, but you're not really articulating it right because there's so much going on and so many questions being asked, and sometimes you just show it, like either storyboards or with figures.
And it helps me too, you know, it's helpful to me too. And then I'm always, you know, whenever I'm watching movies, I'm always freezing the frame and watching how, you know, how they blocked something or how the camera's moving, or, you know, when they get into back overs and stuff, how do they swing that? How did they get around, you know? I'm sure you must have, and Jennifer, you too, loads of favorite shots from movies that sometimes we'd be on set and I'd think, oh, this is that shot I always wanted to do. I think it would work here.
Yes.
Do you think we can do it, Kevin? You know, is this one of those? Can we do it? And you'd say, yeah, I think maybe we could make that happen, you know, so.
No, I think we have to sort of steal from the best and make them our own. I think that, why not? Why would you not do that? It's what everyone does, right? It's, we're just adapting someone's good work. I think that's the highest form of flattery, I suppose, isn't it, for them? But but during that time, were you, you're still scripting, you said you're always kind of up, that development process, and maybe it was just before you even got to Chicago, that sort of writing together, working together as a team now, you know, now it's very real. We've got a director on board, the script's ready, but let's tweak it. What was that process like working together, and any advice for working, you know, with a director or with a screenwriter?
For me, it was at first unnerving. And as it progressed, we found our rhythm. And I think that that's probably the most important step to reach, is where you're both at a mutual respect and honoring of the other half that you're working with, and just being able to flow back and forth. I think to me, one of my favorite approaches is, okay, well, this is why I wrote it this way. So let me explain that. And then if you still want to change it, we'll figure it out. Because a lot of times I think when you're writing a script for years, there's a lot of things that aren't really maybe coming across, or they're not going to come across until it's visual or in the editing process. And coming in early, people can go, oh, cut this or get rid of that or change that line, without realizing that it's connected to many other things. So it's just it's just about a mutual respect of each other. So I think Tracy and I really found our groove with that, especially being on set together. I think that we learned to defer to the other with certain things. You know, like, she was one of the only parents on set. So whenever there were any, you know, references that we needed with parenting, you know, she'd be first in line. And, you know, I wasn't the only lesbian on set, but I was, you know, the lesbian writer. So whenever there was questions about that, like, I had what I call the straight alarm. So I'd be at monitor, and if there was something happening, you know, with the actresses, I'd yell, you know, my straight alarm's going off, and Tracy would, you know, we'd confer and we'd adjust, and, you know, I'd go talk to the actresses and say, okay, like, a lesbian doesn't talk that way or move that way, or try not kissing her like she's your sister. So, you know, but that was fun. That's where the fun lied. And we were able to just really learn to bounce off of each other in a really productive way.
No, that's incredible. Just on that then, were your leads, they weren't gay, they're not lesbians, your two?
Oh, no, they're both straight. One's married, one's engaged. Yeah.
I didn't know that. See, that's great. I actually thought they were, so they played it so well, so you both did obviously brilliantly to get to that stage. That's fascinating. How wonderful. Tracy, from your side then, working, you know, with a scriptwriter, because I've done this and I've done the other side, I've done both. How did you feel coming into something? It's always difficult sometimes. As a director, to come in, you need to sort of not stamp your authority, but say what you'd like, because it's your vision, your world. But then you're also treading on toes at that point. It's a very delicate place. How did you balance that?
Well, I firstly tried hard to, in a sense, honor Jennifer's vision and Joe's too, because it was their story. It was Jennifer's script. And yeah, I felt like a guest on set. So I just tried to keep that in mind. But, you know, and at the end of the day, our goal was the same, was to tell this story of these characters and what was the best way to do that. So, but in reading the script, especially at the beginning, every now and then there was a scene and I would just think to myself, well, how are we going to make this work? You know, practically speaking, how can we possibly film this and keep it interesting? How can we keep the ball in the air?
Yes.
And keep the story rolling. So those were, you know, my underlying concerns, like, all the time. And another one was, even though we don't see the little boy except at the beginning, where is he? Like, in every scene, I wanted to know where is he? I felt like we had to account for him so that to keep his presence alive, but also just, you know, like, to keep people from asking, you know, those what we call refrigerator questions, you know, when the movie's over and you're like going to, you know, get something out of the fridge and you think, now, wait a minute, why did they do that? Why didn't so-and-so come and take the money, or, you know, whatever it was? It's that scene from Thelma and Louise when Louise leaves all that money that her boyfriend just gave her with Thelma, and the Brad Pitt character runs off with it. You know, why didn't she hang on to that money? That's a refrigerator question. But anyway, it's needed as a plot point. So anyway, yeah, those were my concerns, just to know that we were going to keep the ball in the air, keep the story, the momentum going, and account for Bo the whole time. So you don't have to explain everything to everyone. Like, you just have to, as long as it's working, fine, we got it now. Let's move on to the next part, you know.
What was one of the main reasons for, obviously, child actors always can be, you know, it's not necessarily easy, but was that obviously a conscious choice to not really show the child at all? Was that something that you said from the beginning, let's do it this way? Because it was bold and really interesting. But I just wanted to ask those questions.
That was Jennifer and Joe's decision. And so I, you know, had to come to it like, it was an amazing challenge, you know, like, wow, okay, this is what we have. How can we make this work? It brought a lot of interesting solutions, you know?
Yes.
Yeah, very, very early on, right when I was hired to write the script, I had rewatched Hitchcock's Rebecca for the 10th mm-hmm. time, which is sure. one of my favorite yep. movies. And
yeah.
I just love how Rebecca's essence is a character present throughout the entire film. And it struck such a chord in me that I just knew that's how we had to approach Rainbow's End, and that Bo wouldn't be seen, so that we could truly home in on his effect on their relationship without having the audience start to develop their own ideas or their own biases based on, you know, their past with their parents or the way they were raised, or, you know, having sympathy mm-hmm. with this or that. It's just a pure, here's his essence, here's how he affects their relationship and who they are as people. And it just gives you a purity. And I knew it needed to be that way. And I'm really happy that I fought for it the whole way through.
Yeah. It certainly makes, because at the time you're watching it, you're going, I want to see the child. I want to see the child. But then I really enjoyed that we didn't, because therefore I was wanting to see the child, and therefore it worked because of the relationships and what was going on. And I thought it was bold and really interesting. Jen, do you mind giving our listeners a rundown of what the film's about? Really nice short little log line. And then I'll play the trailer.
Yes. So Rainbow's End is about a prominent lesbian couple back in the 90s, one of whom is a politician. And she runs on the platform of acceptance. She and her partner, Jules, adopt a child who very soon they come to learn has behavioral issues. They see that his behavior is unacceptable, so it makes them challenge everything that they've stood for in the past.
We're ready, right? Ready's for people who wait too long.
I don't know how Hannah thinks she has time to be a mother.
Rainbow. Perfect, don't you think? Rainbow's cute. Two lesbians with a kid named Rainbow and a cat.
You're the modern day picture perfect family. How's everything with Bo?
Harley.
Again.
Bo tried it. Something's not right, Hannah.
Bo's detached behavior does fit right in with my findings. He has an extra Y chromosome. Some research suggests that this extra chromosome may actually predispose boys to aggression.
Mayor Driver?
What boy doesn't have a tendency toward aggression?
Is it still there? You're fire.
What's in here, babe?
Do you love any of it?
All I ever wanted was to live with you and our family in a little apartment until we had enough money to afford that cabin.
All of this was for you.
My safe spot was always us.
Was?
Amazing. It's a really nice trailer as well. It's really well put together, and it explains the film. It explains everything about it. Let's talk about being on set then, because Jen, often writers aren't on set. You know, writers are, you know, thanks very much. Cheers for writing that. Take care. What did you find that your process was when you're there? Because sometimes you can feel like, okay, well, what's my role here? What shall I do? So how did you fit in? How did you put it? Did you just get stuck in and move things around and get involved? You know, it's an indie film at the end of the day. So what happened for you?
I can see why directors don't want writers on set. I'm sure Tracy will attest to that. I think that we made it work, but I could totally understand if I was a director directing someone else's script, I would not want them anywhere near me. So I totally get it. But very early on, when we started getting real about it and saying, okay, we have enough funding, this is all starting to happen, Joe was like, I want you on set. I want you to be the script supervisor. Not knowing what that entailed, I was like, yes. And then I just learned everything about what it meant to be a script supervisor. So as we got closer, I found more and more places where I could play a more beneficial role. And I had talked to Joe about it. I asked Tracy if it was okay if I was on set. And I showed up in Chicago just kind of like, tell me what to do and I'll do it, and anywhere I was needed. And so that's what I did. I just jumped in and I worked with the props department and production design. And I mean, everyone. I was working with the lighting, and I just anywhere anyone needed me. I couldn't wait to jump in. And I learned so much from being on set. And it's totally changed the way that I approach my scripts.
Isn't that amazing? It's like the first thing you sort of want to say to on any script writing course or whatever is, if you're on set, you'll become a better writer. You'll certainly learn more about why your scripts aren't working or why they are working, because you're on set and you go, oh, right, yeah. Well, they can't come through that door from there to there because there's no door, or that character arc doesn't work now, because you see it, don't you? It's an amazing thing as a script writer to be on set and see how it does or doesn't work.
Yeah, and it also gives you a better scope of where your time is invested wisely when you're writing a script and where you're wasting your time. And it's like, if you're not adding to the visual representation of what's in your head on the page, then don't waste time on it.
Mm. Could you give an example of that for our listeners?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think that you could get really bogged down in the details of what you see. Like, for example, you could write an action line that says, you know, she walks in with her teacup with the tea bag, you know, hanging over the edge. Like, that's a waste of your time. Yes, it's in your head and it's visual and it's pretty, but you're not writing a novel. It's like, you know, she scurries in slamming the teacup down. Okay, that's visual. Now we also get an example of, or a taste of what she's feeling, or maybe what she's going through, what kind of energy she has. If you're not telling a visual story with your words, don't even bother wasting time on it.
Amazing. That's great. Thanks, Jennifer. Tracy, for you on set then, working with actors as well, and it's something that can be daunting, it can be difficult. Here you've got amazing actors. You know, Sean Young is fantastic. Edward Asner, you know, and your leads, the two girls, absolutely delightful. How was it for you to jump in, you know, and work with actors on set? What's the process for you?
That's my favorite part of filmmaking, is working with the actors. I have so much respect for actors, and they're sort of these magical beings, you know, who can turn into something else. They're just incredible. But so my goal is always to, you know, create that safe space for them, make them feel as real, you know, comfortable as possible, and feel free to try different things, that they don't just have to do it my way. What Sean Young, I was a little intimidated and excited to meet her, because I mean, I absolutely adore Blade Runner, and you know, I was meeting a replicant, you know. God,
is she real? Let's pull the skin off.
Well, so, you know, since she came on set that night, you know, before, and we got to chat and showed her around and everything. And, you know, I was just thinking about it when I went home, and I thought, God, you know, she's so experienced, and she just knows everything I'm thinking. She knows everything that's going through my head. So the next morning, when I first met her again, I said, you know, I said, Sean, are you psychic? And she just laughed and laughed. She said, oh, you can feel it. I'm like, yes, I can feel it. So, you know, you don't really even direct someone like Sean Young or Ed. They're already in character. They know what to do. They know how to use the camera. It's, you know, it's just like, here's the key to the Ferrari and off you go. You know, there's nothing. But I loved working with, you know, the Amanda and Janelle. They're just so dedicated and really fine actresses, both of them. Mm-hmm. And as we worked, they got to know each other better. The characters got to know each other better. And I felt like as the film went on, I did less and less directing because I didn't need to, although every now and then somebody would come in. And yeah, a lot of directing too is blocking and choosing those camera angles so that the important moments of the scene pop out. That's really fun. I love the way that happens.
Yeah, it is. It's wonderful, isn't it? It as soon as the actors have settled in, you know, week in, you're like, oh great, now we can play. There's none of this, oh, what have I been before, what happened in, you know, 1996, don't care, it's irrelevant now, because that's all embedded and you're there and you can find the nuances within the scenes, which is an absolute delight as a director to do.
I was just going to say, to feel the energy of a scene and feel the energy build, and you want it to build, and to know where it's going, like what's the line in this scene that we need to really show, like, and how are we going to work with the eye line, you know, and the screen direction? When can we change the screen direction? And, you know, what can we do to make the important parts pop? That's the goal, really.
Yeah. So how did you go about getting the movie distributed then and out there? Because now you've shot it, you're happy. Well, you know, you're in the edit process. You're again learning so much with the edit side of it. How then did you then move forward and get distribution? How did it happen for you?
Well, it was definitely very strange because of the pandemic. So we couldn't go the normal route. Joe very quickly started looking into other routes, and he came across Lesflix, which is a lesbian and bisexual streaming service based in the UK. And the more he talked with them, he was like, this is the perfect pairing. And it just kept getting better the more he talked with them.
So good. What advice would you give to an upcoming, hardworking, intelligent filmmaker now who's wanting to make their first movie?
I would say to, you know, a lot of it's about raising the money to make the film, but I would say choose the lowest budget script you can. Pick a small film that has few actors, so that you can really do a good job with something small. And even in a feature, small is beautiful. That's what I would say. Make a feature, but and get the best people you can on the job and get at the best advice you can. So go to the best DP you can get. If you can find a very seasoned, like Dennis Maloney, who made Neighbors with me, I mean, he shot over 500 features.
Wow.
You know, he's in the American Cinematographers Guild. Most of his early work was all done using, you know, real film. And he's just a master of lighting. And, you know, work with the masters if you can. And then if you can find someone who will let you hang around on set, shadow sets. You know, that's what Steven Spielberg did at the beginning, I think. He just hung around and just watched what people are doing. But it's kind of like playing a musical instrument. If you try to play in the orchestra that's really above your level, you'll rise to that level. So always try for the best. It's never good enough. Always try for the best.
That's amazing.
That's what I think. But, you know, and then just know that it won't be perfect.
I love that. Always play with the best orchestra. That's fabulous. I love that. And from a screenwriting perspective, Jennifer, what's advice could you give someone coming up now?
I would say keep it simple, follow your heart always, no matter what, and believe that it can happen for you.
Great advice. It's so true, and it can. This has been so lovely. Thank you so much, Jennifer Cooney, Tracy Wren. This has been a delight. Rainbow's End is available on Lesflix now online. You can go watch it. Links will be in the show notes, as always. Where can people find you online? Have you got social media presence yourself that people can say, write in and say, well done? Have you got Twitter following?
I'm in Twitter, Tracy Wren, and I'm on Instagram, which is, I think it's Tracy Wren Stories. Yeah, and I'm on Facebook, Tracy Wren and Tracy Wren Photography, because I also do still photography. And I do have a website, but I'm working to build it up a little bit more.
My social media handle is HalfJackSnap, and my website is HalfJackGeneration, after my production company.
Perfect. I love it. Do go follow them there and support, and go out there and make your indie film. You can make it happen. And if you're lucky enough to rise up and do well, it is your duty to send the elevator back down. We will see you next Tuesday. As always, go out there and make your film. Be inspired by Jennifer and Tracy. Thank you so much, girls, for coming on. This has been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you, Giles. Thank you so much.
Pleasure. Take care, everyone. All the best. Bye.